May these be your words for your people this morning. Amen. All right, so we are talking about being in the middle of a story today, if you can't tell. But I have a question to start us out. How many are familiar with the story of the Wizard of Oz? Show of hands. Oh, good. I was really hoping we would be familiar with this one. So just, if we're not, I'll give you the very brief overview, right? The Wizard of Oz is a story of Dorothy, this young girl from Kansas, and her dog, who are picked up by a tornado, taken to the land of Oz, meet all these characters, including Glinda the Good Witch, the Tin Man, the Scarecrow, the Cowardly Lion. They go to defeat the Wicked Witch of the West. There's singing, there's dancing, there's conflict and drama. They all click their heels and go home at the end, right? And you can go, there's a picture of them, yeah, right? There's no place like home. We're familiar with this story at this point. So, now, how many of you are familiar with the musical Wicked? Less hands, but familiar. You will start hearing a lot about it now that I've mentioned it, and your phones are going to pick it up, but also because it's coming out in theaters in November. So if you're seeing a lot of, like, very bright pink and very bright green things paired together, they're talking about Wicked. So Wicked is a Broadway musical based on a book that they're turning into a movie that's about the Wicked Witch of the West, whose name is Alphaba, and Glinda, before Dorothy arrives in Oz. They are roommates in the Oz equivalent of college, and it's their lives, and it makes Oz a much more complicated place. And it gives backstories to all of the characters that you meet that Dorothy doesn't know. The Tin Man and the Scarecrow and the Cowardly Lion have these stories in the movie, in the musical Wicked, that Dorothy has no idea are there. And the two characters, the two witches, have to figure out the wizard isn't a great man. What are they going to do? The story gets a lot more complicated in this version, in Wicked, in this world, than the one we see in The Wizard of Oz. What we realize if you see both is that The Wizard of Oz is one small, complete story that happens in the middle of a much more complicated story. The point isn't the same, like the take home. No Place Like Home is not the takeaway from Wicked. Right? The stories are much more, they're different, they're complicated. Wizard of Oz becomes a self-contained story in the middle of a bigger, much more complicated story. And if you may walk away with slightly different feelings about The Wizard of Oz once you know some more about this character's backstories. And obviously this is not a real life thing. But it's very fun, and it shows that idea of the middle versus a bigger story being more complicated, more confusing, a little bigger, a little harder to tell. A completed story at the beginning, middle, and end is much easier to tell, contain, reflect on, versus a messier, ongoing story. And unfortunately for us, most of our lives is the middle of an ongoing, complicated story. Most of the time, we don't know the clear beginning, middle, and end. Sometimes we know, but most of the time we don't. It means we spend a lot of time in the middle of stories. Stories that take time. There are points where it's not complete yet. Where there's all these, like, if you're in a murder mystery novel, right? Where there's, like, all these random clues and loose threads. And then you're like, I don't know what's happening. How could we possibly figure this out? And it hasn't wrapped itself up yet. And it's fun in a murder mystery novel. It's not so fun in real life, where there's, like, loose ends and we don't know and we lay in bed trying to figure it all out. Unfortunately, that's most of our lives. And unfortunately, that's most of our God stories, too, that we're in the middle of them. Have you noticed when we've talked about God stories the last few weeks at church that we've always talked about them after they're done? They're already all completed. We never tell a story during the God story, because a God story only works when you've had time to reflect on it, which means it's finished. God moments are, in essence, able to happen immediately, right? You saw a thing, you noticed God, it was beautiful, it was sad, it was moving. But a God story is a story, which means it's longer and more complicated and harder to figure out. We've looked at a lot of stories over the last month. We talked about of God meeting God's people. We did Elijah and the prophets of Baal and Elijah in the wilderness last week. We did disciples on the road to Emmaus who encountered Jesus on the road but didn't recognize him. The week before, we talked about Moses at the burning bush. We talked about the rich man who was invited to follow if he gave up all his money. And we talked about Joseph. His whole life is one big God story. All of these are powerful stories of God inviting his followers to meet with him. All of these stories involve people paying attention enough to realize that this is God and that God is asking them to start something. But all of these stories are finished. All of them have a start, a growing tension, and a conclusion. There is time to reflect afterwards where God has met them, what lessons there were to learn, why this may have happened. They're all finished. What we don't have in any of these storytellings, they don't end. So the story of Emmaus does not end with a long and confusing discussion of how afraid they are that their life had just been turned upside down and Jesus had been killed. It doesn't end there, even though they were feeling that. The story does not end with Elijah in deep despair over the death of all of his colleague prophets and the fear that he too was going to die, even though he felt that. It tells us that in the story, but it doesn't end the story there. We don't have that jolt of insight from the rich young ruler when he realizes that he's not brave enough to follow Jesus. We don't have that because we're not in it anymore. We're not living it. We don't have years in prison with Joseph. We get to skip over that years in prison with like two lines in the text. So we're not living it. We're looking at complete stories when they're all put together. You don't have to live the hard parts. But when it's your God story, you have to live the hard parts. And you have to walk through it, and it's almost impossible to make sense of when you're still in it. And sometimes you may have a sense that this is going to be a God story eventually, right? You're like, there's enough Jesus stuff going on that probably at some point we will know what is happening and God will explain it to us after we have time to reflect on it. But sometimes it's just really hard and we don't really know, because being in the middle of an ongoing God story is one of the hardest places to be. So being in the middle of something like God inviting you to take on a new job, to trust him in a medical thing that just doesn't seem like it's being solved, to follow out the steps that are laid out before you even though they don't make sense, it's one of the most common places for Christians to be and one of the hardest places for Christians to be. But God is with us even in the midst of these when we cannot see it. So I think when we find ourselves in the middle of a God story, there are three main responses we're going to have based, and they're all biblical responses to being in a story we don't understand. So we're either totally confused about what's going on. We have no idea. We're just doing the best we can every day. We are really, really afraid of what's coming next, or we're really sad and angry about because we don't like it. And all of these are biblical responses to unresolved in the middle of stories. God is with us in these stories. God is walking with us before they resolve in the scary, in the confusing, in the angry, in the pain. But it'd be hard to see because we're not of how we're feeling. This is part of why it's so important to practice God stories. So that way when we're in the middle of one and we can't see God, we have something to draw back on and be like, I remember God has met me here before. I am hopeful God will meet me here again. Or you hear someone else's story, and if you can take away the, well, why did it happen to you and not to me part, sometimes you can hear the, okay, God is with them. God is probably with me too. Why we share these, why we practice these for these hard moments. And it's okay to not be able to see God all the time. It won't last forever. Some of us may be there now, some of us may not be there right now, but my hope is that we can be encouraged that God is with us, even if our primary emotions right now are fear or anger or confusion. Hopefully we'll be able to see how God weaves it together in the end. So our first response to being in the middle of a God story is being confused. And my favorite example of the Bible is always the disciples. Do I have a picture of this one, or do I have to wait? Okay, go one more or two more. Here you go. They have no idea what's going on ever, and it always makes me a little happier. They're trying, but they don't know what Jesus is talking about. And, like, when you read the Gospels, it actually gets kind of funny, because sometimes you're like, it's so explicit, and they're like, we don't get it. And you're like, but he just, like, said it, and there wasn't even, like, metaphor. He just, like, straight out said it, and we still don't get it. So, like, today's Gospel passage, which we can go back, Janet, because I did put this up. Then he took the 12 aside and said to them, look, we are going up to Jerusalem, and everything that is written about the Son of Man by the prophets will be accomplished. He will be handed over to the Gentiles, and he will be mocked and insulted and spat upon. And after they have flogged him, they will kill him, and on the third day he will rise again. You're like, okay, this is pretty much what happens. If you read any of the Easter stories, you're like, yep, check, check, check. Look, we're going to go to Jerusalem. I'm going to be handed over to the Romans, who are going to insult me and spit on me and kill me, and then 3 days later, I'm going to come back to life. He, like, says it. Great. It's happening. And then we get verse 34, right? But they understood nothing about all these things. What he said was hidden from them, and they did not grasp what he said. And now we can get the confused disciples again. Mm-hmm. They have no idea what Jesus is talking about. And a part of me is like, how can you miss it, right? Like, it's right there. Even though, like, I'm very aware of my ability to miss things, so I need to give them a little more grace. But I wonder if part of why they miss it is because Jesus is there, right? They're actually living it. They're feeling the growing tension in Israel. They know that going to Jerusalem is not the most astute idea right now. They're used to Jesus talking in metaphors, yelling at religious leaders, doing miracles. They've seen all of these things, but Jesus is there. All the work they did to write the Gospels hasn't happened yet. The Gospels are not diary entries. They're reflections after some time on what happened. Everything makes sense now. But how could it be then? They couldn't fit the pieces together. They had an inkling that Jesus was going to be there to save them. They thought it was from the political structure they were under. They couldn't have imagined it was from all evil and sin from all time. How could they ever know that? How could that possibly be the case when they're following after Jesus on dusty trails? When we're young, we have some ideas and hopes and dreams for where our lives are going to turn out. And if you went back and talked to your younger self and showed them where you were, would they be like, I'm confused. How did we get here? And you may be like, yeah, I'm confused too. And I did it. And I still don't really know how we got here. Not understanding kind of the whole path or what's happening, I think, is actually the common experience of Jesus followers. There's a verse in Isaiah that I really like. It's Isaiah 55:8-9. My thoughts are not your thoughts, neither are your ways my ways. As the heavens are higher than the earth, so my ways are higher than your ways, and my thoughts than your thoughts. Apparently, we're not going to know what's going on. So if you're feeling confused or disoriented about your way, the path you're on, you may be in a God story. And it's okay to be confused about it. But it's also okay to ask Jesus about it. Be like, I am confused and I don't know what's happening, and can you help me out? Sometimes we forget we can pray that prayer. We, as caveat, you may not like the answer you get if you ask that. But we are sometimes afraid to even ask. And presenting confusion to God is very biblical, and God will always meet us in our confusion. So sometimes in the middle of a God story, we're feeling confused, but sometimes in the middle of a God story, we're feeling scared. Because God asks us to do scary things sometimes, and the only thing we can do is be faithfully afraid. and keep going. So if you've grown up in church, you've probably heard, we can go to a blank page for a minute, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego before. You did a great job reading with all of the names and the instruments and all the things. Good job, Lydia. So the three young men who refused to bow before the statue of King Nebuchadnezzar, and then he throws them in the furnace, and then God saves them with the fourth figure in the fire. It's classic. There's like kids' books and all this art and, you know, flannel graphs of this story. And they're held up as examples of being faithful in trouble, that God will rescue us. But there's a lot of context to the story and the statements they make that's important, because they're in a God story, and it's not an easy one. And this is just one little glimpse of it. So this is me being a nerd. You all have to walk with me for a second. So in the Old Testament timeline, this is way at the end. We're way past where we were last week. This is the end, kind of nearing the end. The kingdom has divided. There's the northern, southern kingdom. The northern kingdom had been exiled already. They've been taken away by Assyria. Goodbye. The southern kingdom is about 200 years later, and the Babylonians are coming. And the Babylonian, everybody in Jerusalem, I think everyone in Jerusalem is like, no, 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 they're not going to defeat us. We're going to be fine. God will rescue us. We are his people. We didn't fall last time, right? Assyria came and we were safe, so we aren't going to fall to Babylon this time. There's like one or two prophets that are like, no, no, we are. We're going to all die. And they're like, we don't want to listen to you. So there's an invading army. They're under siege. They keep being like, God will rescue us. God will rescue us. God will rescue us. And God does not. Jerusalem falls to the Babylonians. So I think there's a picture that will come up. Now, the Babylonians had this technique where when they would conquer a city, they would take all of the well-educated, all of the upper class, all the craftspeople, and take them to the capital city, leaving just the, like, peasants and farmers who didn't have enough bandwidth or education to plan an uprising. So they would have, like, a governor show up to, like, collect taxes and food and just leave everything destroyed and take all the rich people to the capital to work for them. So there was four young Hebrew men that were growing up in Jerusalem and were from upper class families. They were taken from Jerusalem, and their names were Hananiah, Mishael, Azariah, and Daniel. These are the four men. So they show up in Jerusalem. They show up from Jerusalem, their family being taken from their families, being taken from their culture, being taken from their home, watching God not rescue the city. And then they're put to work in Babylon. They work for the king as governors. And, yeah, they know God is not always going to save them. They have seen it happen. They know that faith alone was not enough to save Jerusalem. Because Hananiah and Mishael and Azariah are Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. For some reason, we keep their Babylonian names and Daniel's Hebrew name. And I have no idea why church history has done that. So these three men, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, are governors. They are lead positions in the government for King Nebuchadnezzar. And the king commands them to worship an idol statue that he made. And if not, they're all going to be killed. So it would have been easier for the three of them to just do it, right? To just bow down and ask for forgiveness. They are in a foreign country, in a foreign culture, having been taken away. But they also were good Jewish boys and knew that worshiping an idol is one of the Ten Commandments not to break. And so they come up to God and they go to the king, and this man is in charge of their jobs. This man is in charge of the army that destroyed their home. And they sell him. I think we have this one typed out. If we are thrown into the blazing furnace, the God we serve is able to deliver us from it. And he will deliver us from your majesty's hand. But even if he does not, we want you to know, your majesty, that we will not serve your gods or worship the image of gold you have set up. Notice that our God is able to. But even if he doesn't, our God can. Even if he doesn't, they do know who God is. These young men recognize God. have had God moments, have learned to listen to God's voice, and they saw their city destroyed and their lives changed forever. They know that God may not rescue them, but they know that God can and is able to, and they decide to go for it anyway. So I think there's just a picture of this. Most of the pictures show the rescue, but they didn't know that was coming. The amount of faith and courage that took, they must have been so afraid. They must have assumed that they were not going to miraculously survive. You don't assume that. You hope that. Based on past life experience, they knew that God was with them and loved them, was with them in their troubles, but doesn't necessarily guarantee what's coming next. They did it afraid. I can't tell you the amount of people when I moved out here from Massachusetts that told me how brave I was being. I have to tell you, I didn't feel very brave. But I knew it was right. I knew it was part of my God story that I'm still in the middle of, but that step was scary. It was scary to move alone across the country to all of you all that I don't know. I trusted that you all were great. I trusted that God was calling me here. I was trusting I would find a place to live and a community and all these things, but I had to go without knowing. So I knew as part of a God story that one, it was part of a call, and two, it was scary. Not nearly as scary as these guys. But doing it afraid is part of it. Have you ever had that invitation to step out in faith, to leave your comfort zone, to try something new and was scared about it? It's easier not to stay in the familiar, to have bowed down to the statues and asked for forgiveness. To see God in those God moments, but not actually to follow the invitation because it's new and scary. But if you think God is leading you, it is okay to do it afraid. I think sometimes we get it. We're told as Christians we're not supposed to be afraid because God is with us. And I would say it's more that we're not supposed to not do it because we're afraid, because God is with us. Being afraid in the middle of your God story might assure you it is a God story. God is still with you even when you are afraid. So a final emotional response to being in a God story is anger and lament, which is hard to talk about because people don't like to feel that way usually. But it is accurate, and it seems only fitting that when we talk about being in the middle of a God story, we talk about Job. One thing that I always struggle with Job is that Job doesn't know what's happening and never does. We get the little prologue that's like God and the accuser are having this whole conversation. But Job never does. Job never gets a why. Job never gets a who. He just has it happen to him. It's unfair to him. And his life has turned into something terrible that he didn't want. And he doesn't think he deserves it. And so he talks to God about it. So it's, in prayer terms, when we talk about it in scripture, it's called formally a lament. So they have psalms of lament or prayers of lament, and most of Job, when Job talks, is a lament. His friends are giving him, like, philosophical advice, and Job is upset. So this is verses 25, 26, and 27 of chapter 30. Have I not wept for those in trouble? Has not my soul grieved for the poor? Yet when I hoped for good, evil came. And when I looked for light, then came darkness. The churning inside me never stops. Days of suffering confront me. And if we're honest, we know this feeling. We just don't always think that we can tell God about it. When life gets hard, some of us immediately blame God, and some of us think we can't blame God. It makes sense if the God is the Almighty, the creator of the universe, like we claim he is, to be like, what's wrong? Why is this happening? I don't like it, and it's not good. And we will have moments like this if we're honest. And it may be part of a God story. It may be when it's finished, you can look back on it and see the completed picture of what God was doing. And some parts of our life are just going to be hard. And the reflective of how God moved in it won't happen until we actually see Jesus face to face. My family has some of those. That all we can figure is someday. Someday this will make sense. The important part is to tell Jesus. To not be afraid to call out to him and remind him of how hard this is, being in a story. Jesus can handle your anger and your pain. You don't need to keep it to yourself. Sometimes you just gotta let it out and tell Jesus that you don't like it. And that is okay. There is a long history of that. Now there is a good chance that many of us in the room are in the middle of a God story. God is inviting, and we are accepting the invitation and stepping into something. But it's not yet resolved. We can't sit, and that structure I gave that first week, right, about this is the story of what happened, and this is the scripture it reminds me of, and this is what I've learned about God or about people. And you're like, that's great, Pastor Becca, but I'm still over here being like, I don't even know what's happening, let alone what verse it reminds me of, except maybe the disciples being like, we don't get it. And that's okay. When you're in the middle of a God story, it doesn't fit yet. We don't know where we're going. We're mostly confused or scared or sad or afraid or angry and hanging on to hope and the memory of how Jesus has met us before or met people that we love. And hoping that eventually this will turn into a story with a conclusion and an epilogue. And that is okay. Take your confusion and your fear and your anger and to Jesus in the middle of your story. You keep following and talking to Jesus about it, because what we can guarantee is that Jesus is with you, even when the story is still incomplete. So we're going to sit a second. With that idea, you can keep the art up. Sometimes it's helpful to reflect on a piece. And then I will come to prayer. So just see if something resonates. If that idea of a story that brings in your life right now, if confusion or fear or sorrow is a little more applicable than hope and joy, and that is okay. Good Shepherd, you travel with us by still, clear waters and in the valley of the shadow of death both. Help us to see you in the middle of our stories, to know that you are with us, to share honestly whatever is on our hearts with you. Remind us today that you love us always, even when we can't tell. Amen.
I was just thinking, as Pastor Becca was talking, this hymn that we're concluding with was written by someone who was in the middle of one of those God stories, and it's probably familiar to some of you, but Horatio Spafford, who wrote the text to It Is Well With My Soul, had just lost his entire fortune in the Great Chicago Fire. His son, his four-year-old son, died of scarlet fever. Their family was in distress, so he sends his wife and his daughters over to England for a vacation, planning to join them later. The boat tragically crashes into another ship. His daughters drown. His wife continues on to England in her grief, and he is on his way to England to join her. And while he is over that spot in the ocean where those ships collided, God speaks to him and gives him these words, and he pens these in the midst of his sorrow and his grief and his confusion and his anger. He turns to Jesus. And so we can also borrow these words in the middle of our God story, even when we don't see the end yet. We have this last verse: Lord, haste the day when my faith shall be sight, the clouds be rolled back as a scroll, the trumpet shall sound and the Lord shall descend. Even so, it is well with my soul. So we do know our future. And so let's come before the Lord in the middle of our stories with Horatio Spafford.